So what if I told you that the traditional natural way of raising livestock, free-range animals, wandering the open plains, grazing on natural grasses, what if I told you that is actually far worse for the climate than highly managed commercial farming?
I mean, it completely upends that whole pastoral ideal we're so used to hearing
That,
about, right?
because, well, it goes against everything we assume about natural farming.
Exactly. We carry this really ingrained assumption that natural automatically equals low impact. We picture this small herd of cattle or goats just roaming a vast landscape, and we think of it as, harmonious with the earth.
Right, like it's just the circle of life.
Yeah, but when you actually apply rigorous carbon accounting to that exact picture, the math tells a vastly different and honestly a far more complicated story.
Which is exactly the mission of today's deep dive. We are unpacking the super complex intersection of climate science, global agriculture, and basically human survival.
Because, I mean, we have a growing planet, right?
Exactly. We have to figure out how to feed everyone without totally overheating the atmosphere. And to get to the bottom of this, we are looking at a 2026 research article from the Australian Journal of Agricultural, Veterinary, and Animal Sciences.
Right, the study by Mohammed and their team.
Yeah, that's the one. And they essentially built an inventory of greenhouse gas emissions from livestock. But they didn't just take some quick, generic, global snapshot. They used 25 years of hard, on-the-ground data, specifically from Nigeria.
And Nigeria is, honestly, it's perhaps the ultimate case study for this specific challenge.
Why is that? Like, what makes Nigeria the perfect focus here?
Well, you have a rapidly growing human population, really rapid urbanization, and an economy where livestock is not just, some culinary luxury.
Right, it's not just grabbing a burger on a Friday night.
Exactly. In the West, a steak or a piece of lamb might be a weekend treat, and so the prevailing climate advice is often just, well, eat less meat.
Yeah, we hear that all the time. Just do meatless Mondays.
Right. But for millions of rural households in developing nations, these animals are their fundamental socioeconomic lifeline. I mean, they function as a bank account, an insurance policy against crop failure, and a daily source of sustenance.
So telling a rural farmer to just, give up their livestock to save the climate is basically telling them to voluntarily enter extreme poverty.
Exactly. That one-size-fits-all Western solution just falls apart immediately on contact with this reality.
And to really understand the scale of what we are dealing with here, we have to look at the numbers from this study because they are wild. The researchers tracked livestock populations in Nigeria from 1998 all the way to 2022.
A full quarter century of data.
Right. And over that time, cattle populations rose by 34%, going from about 15 million up to nearly 21 million.
And a 34% increase. I mean, that is a massive addition of biological mass to the landscape.
Yeah, because cows are huge.
They are. Cattle are incredibly resource-intensive animals. They require massive amounts of land for foraging and huge volumes of water. Plus, their sheer physical size means they're constantly processing just tons of organic matter.
But the cattle numbers actually kind of pale in comparison to the small ruminants.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Because over that exact same 25-year stretch, the sheep population jumped 134%, going from 22 million to over 50 million.
Which is staggering.
And then goats absolutely exploded. They
Yeah.
went up by 135%, growing from roughly 37 million to over 88 million goats.
88 million. Yeah.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because when you look at that massive disparity, a 34% growth rate for cattle versus 135% for goats, it feels like a deliberate economic strategy,
It
right?
absolutely is.
Are goats and sheep essentially like the startup livestock for these rural farmers? A low barrier entry point requiring way less initial capital than the blue chip investment of a herd of cattle?
That is a great way to frame it. The socioeconomic data fully supports that startup analogy. Small ruminants, like goats and sheep, possess very different biological and economic profiles than cattle do.
So they're just easier to manage.
Much easier. They have much shorter reproductive cycles, meaning a farmer can rebuild a flock really quickly after a drought or some kind of financial shock.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah, and they cost significantly less to purchase. Plus, they are incredibly adaptable to harsh, arid environmental conditions. They can browse on scrub, leaves, and really tough vegetation that cattle simply cannot process or even reach.
So, if you're a household facing severe economic uncertainty, a goat is kind of the ultimate highly liquid financial asset.
Exactly. You can sell a goat quickly to pay for a medical bill or a child's school fees. You can't exactly sell a fraction of a cow.
Right, you're not going to chop off a cow's leg to pay for books.
No, you're not. And this trend of small ruminant populations expanding at a blistering pace compared to cattle, it isn't isolated to Nigeria either. We're seeing this shift across much of sub-Saharan Africa.
Wow, okay.
But there is a vital caveat in the greenhouse gas inventory we are discussing today. Despite the fact that there were over four times as many goats as cattle by 2022, the cattle still produced the vast majority of the total greenhouse gas emissions.
Wait, really? Even with 88 million goats, I would assume that just comes down to sheer body mass, right? Like a full-grown cow is digesting magnitudes more food per day than a goat, meaning the biological exhaust pipe is just that much bigger.
Yeah, the scale of the animal absolutely dictates the volume of the emissions. And that brings us to the actual biological mechanics of where these greenhouse gases originate.
Right, the messy part.
The messy part, yeah.
Yeah.
The research breaks down the two primary culprits in livestock agriculture. The first is enteric fermentation, which generates the vast majority of the methane. And the second is manure management, which generates both methane and nitrous oxide.
And between 1998 and 2022, the total emissions from those two sources in Nigeria increased by over 60%.
Over 60%, yeah.
Let's give some real-world context to those percentages for a second, because the paper drops some incredibly large raw numbers. It states that total enteric methane rose from roughly 1,200 gigagrams in 1998 to almost 2,000 gigagrams in 2022.
Right, and a gigagram is a lot.
Yeah, for anyone who doesn't think in gigagrams, 1,200 gigagrams is 1.2 million metric tons of methane. And since methane is, what, about 28 times more potent than carbon dioxide at warming the atmosphere?
Roughly, yes.
So that 1998 baseline alone is roughly equivalent to the annual greenhouse gas emissions of over 7 million passenger cars. And that number nearly doubled by 2022.
It is just a staggering volume of invisible gas altering the atmosphere.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. Let me push back on this because you might be listening to those massive numbers and thinking about the basic biology of a cow or a goat. Enteric fermentation is really just the scientific term for how these animals digest their food, right?
Basically, yes.
They chew the cud, they digest, and they burp. It is a completely natural prehistoric process. Ruminants have been doing this for millennia, long before industrialization.
Millions of years, yeah.
So why is a natural digestive process suddenly acting like the exhaust from millions of cars? Is this a matter of what they are eating, like running a car engine on dirty, unrefined fuel versus premium, highly refined gas?
That fuel analogy perfectly explains the microbiology happening inside the animal.
Yeah.
So a ruminant's stomach has a specialized compartment called the rumen.
Okay, the rumen.
Right. And inside that rumen, there is this incredibly complex ecosystem of microbes, including what we call methanogenic microorganisms.
Methanogens, got it.
Yeah, and their specific evolutionary job is to sweep up the excess hydrogen that gets produced when the animal's bacteria break down the plant matter they just ate. The methanogens take that hydrogen, combine it with carbon, and they create methane.
Which the animal then exhales or just boops out into the atmosphere.
Exactly. And the critical variable, the dirty fuel in your analogy, is the quality of the forage.
The actual grass they eat.
Yes. In extensive, low-income farming systems, animals aren't eating carefully formulated, easily digestible feed. They are surviving on literally whatever they can find.
So just tough brush and weeds.
Yeah. Low-quality, highly fibrous natural grasses and tough scrub brush. This high-fiber diet is incredibly difficult to break down. It requires a much longer fermentation pathway in the rumen, and that specific chemical pathway generates significantly more hydrogen as a byproduct.
Oh, I see. So more tough fiber means more hydrogen.
Yeah.
And more hydrogen means those methanogenic bacteria go into an absolute feeding frenzy, pumping out way more methane per bite of food than they would if the animal was eating something softer and more nutritious.
Exactly. The poorest farmers can only afford to let their animals graze on marginal lands with tough brush. So as a direct result of that poverty and lack of resources, those specific animals become biological methane factories compared to an animal eating optimized, easily digestible feed.
Wow. Okay, so that covers the front end of the animal, but the paper also zeroes in on the back end. As these herds of cattle, sheep, and goats grow by the tens of millions, so does the sheer mountain of manure.
Yeah, and manure management is a massive piece of the climate puzzle here.
Because it just sits there.
Well, when manure is left to accumulate on grazing lands or piled up in traditional farming systems, it often undergoes anaerobic decomposition.
Meaning without oxygen.
Right. It means the organic matter is breaking down in an environment starved of oxygen. And when microbes break down waste without oxygen, they produce methane.
And the paper heavily emphasizes nitrous oxide emissions coming from the manure as well, right?
It does. Through the processes of microbial nitrification and denitrification, the nitrogen present in the animal's waste is converted into nitrous oxide.
Which is even worse than methane.
Way worse.
Yeah.
While the physical volume of nitrous oxide is much smaller than the volume of methane, the climate impact is just ferocious. Nitrous oxide has a global warming potential roughly 265 times greater than carbon dioxide over a 100-year period.
265 times. That's insane.
So even a fractional increase in nitrous oxide emissions from tens of millions of animals creates a massive spike in the overall carbon footprint.
Okay, but if the exact diet of the animal and the specific way its manure sits on the ground drastically alter the amount of gas produced, how can scientists possibly calculate an accurate national total?
It's definitely a challenge.
I mean, you can't put a breathalyzer on 21 million cows and 88 million goats, and you definitely can't follow them around measuring exactly what kind of tough grass they ate that morning. How do the numbers in this research actually hold up to scrutiny?
Well, this is where the specific methodology highlighted in the paper's title becomes so important. The researchers didn't just guess or use a generic average. They used the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, their Tier 1A protocol.
Tier 1A. Because normally, a basic Tier 1 approach is just a blunt mathematical instrument, right? You take the total number of cows in a country, multiply it by a single generic global average of what a cow burps, and you get your total.
Exactly, which is often very inaccurate for developing nations.
But Tier 1A forces scientists to get highly specific about the living conditions of the animals. It requires dividing the national herds into different systems. Specifically, mm-hmm. They categorize them into low productivity and high productivity systems based on their diet, environment, and management.
Right.
And the paper found that over 70% of the total emissions in Nigeria come from the low productivity systems.
Yeah. And what's fascinating here is that the data forces us to completely reevaluate our assumptions about agricultural efficiency.
Because, wait, low productivity usually means traditional free-range grazing. Doesn't that sound more natural? Why is the natural way responsible for 70% of the greenhouse gases?
Because when we see commercial high-productivity farming, we often just instinctively associate it with high environmental impact. But in livestock systems, animals in low productivity environments have incredibly poor feed conversion ratios.
Meaning they eat massive amounts of that fibrous, dirty fuel, but because the nutrition is so poor, they barely put on muscle mass or they produce very little milk over a long period of time.
Exactly. Because their diet is poor and their genetics are generally not optimized for rapid growth, it takes them much longer to reach a market weight. A cow in a traditional low productivity grazing system might take 3 or 4 years to reach a weight that a cow in a high productivity system receiving optimal nutrition and veterinary care might reach in just 18 months.
Which brings us to the concept of emission intensity. It isn't just about how much gas a cow produces in a day. It's about how much gas it produces per pound of meat or gallon of milk it provides to humanity.
You hit the nail on the head. An animal that takes 4 years to grow is an animal that is actively fermenting tough grass and burping in every single day for 4 years. Because they live longer while producing less food, their emission intensity is drastically higher. The high productivity system, while perhaps looking more industrialized or unnatural, actually emits far less greenhouse gas per unit of food produced. From a strict climate mitigation perspective, maximum efficiency is drastically better for the atmosphere.
That is the counterintuitive reality that sits right at the center of this research. The longer an animal wanders around a natural landscape eating low-quality brush, the worse it is for global warming, which completely changes how we have to think about solutions.
It really does.
If low-efficiency systems are the main culprit, then the goal in a developing nation like Nigeria doesn't have to be eliminating the animals and completely destroying the farmers' livelihoods. The goal is upgrading the systems to achieve high efficiency.
Yes. The mitigation strategies outlined in the research are heavily focused on actionable mechanisms to increase that efficiency. And it starts with the feed.
Upgrading the fuel.
Upgrading the fuel. If we can provide farmers with high-quality forages and balanced nutritional supplements, we immediately change the fermentation pathway in the rumen. Better feed means less hydrogen produced, which means less methane burped out.
And the paper also points to improving the genetics of the herds, right?
Genetic improvement is a powerful climate tool, yeah. If you selectively breed animals that have naturally higher feed conversion ratios, meaning they naturally turn food into muscle faster, you shrink their lifespan prior to market.
Which means less days alive to burp methane.
Exactly. Fewer days alive means fewer days emitting methane.
Yeah.
You are effectively breeding for a lower carbon footprint.
Okay, and what about the mountains of manure we talked about? If leaving it in a stagnant pile creates anaerobic conditions that pump out methane and nitrous oxide, how do we fix the back end of the system in rural environments?
The key is shifting how the waste decomposes. The paper highlights composting and anaerobic digestion as primary solutions.
Okay, so with composting, you are constantly turning the manure, introducing oxygen, right?
Yes, and oxygen is the enemy of methanogenic bacteria. By keeping the decomposition aerobic with oxygen, you drastically reduce the methane output. But anaerobic digestion takes it a step further.
That's where you actually turn the problem into a resource.
You take the manure and place it into a sealed tank, an anaerobic digester. You intentionally let those methanogenic bacteria go to work in an oxygen-free environment.
But instead of the methane venting into the atmosphere, the sealed tank captures it.
Exactly. This captured gas, known as biogas, is highly flammable. Rural communities can burn that biogas for cooking or to generate electricity, replacing fossil fuels or firewood.
That's incredible.
It is. Mm. And once the digester finishes extracting the gas, the remaining solid residue is a highly potent, safe biofertilizer for crops. It's basically the ultimate closed-loop system.
So what does this all mean? We have the biological solutions, better feed, faster growing genetics, and capturing the manure gas. But there is a massive leap between knowing what to do scientifically and actually getting millions of rural farmers in a developing country to adopt these practices.
A huge leap, yeah.
I mean, these upgrades require capital, infrastructure, and education. A farmer barely surviving can't just go buy a commercial anaerobic digester.
Which is why the final recommendation of this paper is perhaps its most crucial. The researchers don't just present the data. They explicitly state that these precise Tier 1A livestock emission inventories must be formally integrated into Nigeria's nationally determined contributions for the Paris Agreement.
The NDCs.
The NDCs, yes.
For anyone unfamiliar, nationally determined contributions are the official, legally binding climate action plans that every participating country submits to the United Nations. It is the literal ledger of how the globe keeps track of our collective progress toward cutting emissions.
But for developing nations, the NDCs serve a much more functional purpose. They are the key that unlocks the vault of international climate finance.
Oh, the funding.
The funding. Organizations like the Green Climate Fund or International Development Banks do not hand out billions of dollars based on vague promises. They require precise, verifiable data. If a country is using the old generic Tier 1 math, they can't prove that upgrading a farm actually reduces emissions.
Because the generic math just counts the number of cows. It doesn't care if the cow is eating tough brush or premium feed. It just assigns the same carbon penalty.
Exactly. But by adopting the Tier 1A methodology, Nigeria can actually measure and prove the emission reductions when a farmer switches to better feed or installs a digester.
Oh, wow. Once a country can prove the reductions scientifically on paper, they can include those specific agricultural upgrades in their NDCs.
Yes, and once it is in the NDC, they can apply for the massive international grants and support mechanisms needed to actually pay for the better feed, the breeding programs, and the biogas digesters. The meticulous accounting literally unlocks the funding.
That is a mind-bending connection to leave you with today. The shifting tides of macro-global geopolitics, the Paris Agreement, and access to billions of dollars in international climate funding literally hinge on the local diet of a Nigerian goat.
Wild to think about.
The process of getting a rural farmer the resources they need to properly compost a pile of manure is directly tied to how well a scientist can measure the microbiology of a single ruminant's stomach.
It proves that in the modern fight against climate change, isolated systems do not exist. The biological processes happening on a small farm in sub-Saharan Africa are inextricably linked to the atmosphere above all of us and to the policy floors of the United Nations.
To solve the global problem, we have to look closely at the microscopic details. If we want to feed a growing world without overheating it, we can't just rely on catchy slogans about eating less meat. We have to do the hard work of understanding the specific on-the-ground realities of the farmers who rely on these animals to survive. We have to provide the tools to make those traditional systems hyper-efficient. Because when you finally see how the farmer's wallet, the goat's rumen, and international climate policy are all completely connected, you can finally start to build solutions that actually work.